We are going to talk about China, North Korea, Egypt, and Russia this hour and the various foreign policy issues that are in the news. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We will start with China and North Korea. Ahead of this week's visit to Mar-a-Lago by China's president, President Trump said in an interview that he is going to ask China to help rein in North Korea. He also said that the United States will unilaterally solve the nuclear threat from North Korea if China fails to help. So what does that mean? And how big a threat is North Korea anyway? And how should the U.S. proceed? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Let me welcome our guest. Happy to have back with us Jeremy Suri. He is the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs, History, and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He is the LBJ School of Public Affairs and the Strauss Center for International Security and Law. He is the author of the forthcoming book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, which will be out in September. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thanks for being back with us.
My pleasure.
We'll talk about your book maybe a little bit. Sneak preview. We'll get a sneak preview in a little later on in the hour. But let's start with President Trump in this interview with the Financial Times over the weekend saying that the U.S. will solve the nuclear threat from North Korea by ourselves should we have to. What did you make of that statement?
Well, I think it's one more statement we've received from the president, which is about bluster and sounding tough, but I don't know what's behind it. There's no evidence that there's really any plan at all. To do this on our own would require some sort of military activity, and there's no evidence that we're preparing for that. There's no credible evidence he's prepared the American public for that, and there's no credible evidence that the South Koreans, who would suffer any damage from that in a retaliation from North Korea, that they're ready for that. So it's a lot of empty rhetoric, really.
Yeah, the remark by Trump comes days before he's scheduled to meet with China's president, Xi Jinping, at Mar-a-Lago. That's this coming Thursday and Friday. Trump said that China has great influence over North Korea and that it will decide whether it wants to help with the North. Does China have a great deal of influence over North Korea, and can China help defuse this this nuclear threat?
Absolutely. This is a point that has been made by everyone who studied this issue, American, Japanese, South Korean. The Chinese provide crucial energy resources and crucial food aid to the North Koreans. So they're in a position to really help us squeeze the North Koreans. They also understand North Korea better than anyone else. So the route to any solution to this problem has to go through China. The problem, Joy, is that the Chinese have always been concerned that if the North Korean regime crumbles, that the United States will move into that area and that they will wake up one morning and have a huge refugee crisis and have American military force at their border. And listeners will remember this was one of the problems during the Korean War in 1950 that American forces approached the Chinese border, and the Chinese were not comfortable with that. They have to trust the Chinese that they can work with Donald Trump on this issue if they're going to help. But by simply asking them to do something and then threatening them with the other side of one's mouth and also threatening them on other issues, it makes it very hard to work with the Chinese on these issues.
Yeah. He added that it will be very good for China if they do, and if they don't, it won't be good for anybody. Why would it be very good for China to be involved here?
Well, there is evidence that we don't know for certain, but there is a fair amount of evidence, Joy, that the Chinese are getting fed up with the North Koreans. They don't want the North Koreans to have an intercontinental ballistic missile capability. They don't want the North Koreans to destabilize the region, and they don't want the North Korean economy to remain in the toilet. These are all sources of instability, and these all create excuses for the United States, Japan, and South Korea to act in more forceful ways. So the Chinese would like the North Koreans to behave themselves better. But they don't have full control over them. But the Chinese, I still think, probably believe it would be worse to have the United States on their border right there. So this is the problem that Donald Trump needs to understand, that the Chinese might be unhappy with the North Koreans, but we need to offer them a better alternative.
Trump refused to say how he would tackle North Korea. He says he doesn't want to give away any secrets. But U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, was asked on Sunday on ABC's This Week what approach the U.S. should take. And here's what she said about that.
No longer take the excuses from China that they're concerned too. They need to show us how concerned they are. They need to put pressure on North Korea. The only country that can stop North Korea is China, and they know that. And I think that you saw when Secretary Tillerson went to Beijing, that was a way of putting pressure. You're going to see President Trump meet with President Xi, and a lot of conversation, and the most important conversation will be how we're going to be dealing with the nonproliferation of North Korea.
So what kind of pressure do we put on China to get tough with North Korea?
We've been doing that for years. The pressure we put on China is we've continually, first of all, told them that we would prefer not to use our own military force. Wouldn't they prefer to do this and help us so we don't have to? We've put economic pressure on them. We've used a lot of levers. The problem is we have our own economic interests in working with China. We don't really want to cut off our own economy from access to the Chinese economy. Ambassador Haley was saying, it just doesn't make sense. You don't get a powerful ally or a powerful counterpart country. Maybe China's not an ally. You don't get them to do what you want by just shaking your fist at them and showing up and telling them do this or else. You've got to offer them something. There has to be an incentive for them, and it has to be a better relationship. They have to trust us. They have to trust that if they help us, we will not take advantage of it. And when you start your administration by calling Taiwan before you call China and violating all the protocol we've established over the last 30 years in how you deal with China, you don't establish that trust. If you don't establish that trust, they're not going to help us. And I think that's where we are right now.
Mm-hmm. What is it that North Korea wants?
North Korea wants to survive. They want a security guarantee. They want us to provide them food aid. And they want us to stop threatening to undermine their regime. But that's very difficult for us to do because the war with South Korea never really ended. And the North Korean regime as such is a constant threat to South Korea. So because of the American interest in South Korea, it's very difficult for us to offer the North Koreans the kind of security they want. But their entire nuclear project is an effort to prevent us from taking them down.
It's estimated that North Korea has as many as 8 nuclear weapons. They've been firing some off toward Japan. It is yet to show that it can attach them to a missile capable of hitting the U.S. How big a threat is North Korea to the U.S. specifically?
Well, I don't think they're the kind of threat that we need to, you know, worry about their starting a major war with us in the way we worried about the Soviet Union or maybe even potentially should be worrying about Russia today. They're not a peer competitor in that sense, but they are a state that has shown a willingness to use excessive force in targeted ways. And they have shown a willingness to be a state sponsor of terrorist activities. The assassination of Kim Jong-un's brother, or half-brother, in Malaysia is an act of terrorism. They've frequently attacked and killed foreign leaders and foreign diplomats. They killed the leader of South Korea, Park Chung-hee, the father of the president who was just impeached in South Korea. So they are an unpredictable regime that can cause great harm. They're not a peer competitor, and we do need to worry about their using their nuclear capability. If there is a state that would use it, they're one of the short list, I think.
We are talking with Jeremy Suri. He is the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs, History, and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He's formerly with the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We are talking with him about President Trump's diplomacy missions this week. He's going to be meeting with China's president later this week, talking about the threat from North Korea. We'll talk some about the latest with Russia and more. We'll welcome your questions and comments, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Back to the meeting with the president of China. President Trump and President Xi are expected to talk about America's $310 billion trade deficit, among other things, when they meet. He, on the campaign trail last year, said that we can't let China rape our country and that it's the greatest theft in the history of the world. Sounds like this is going to be a difficult meeting, Professor Suri.
Well, certainly if anyone on either side talks like that, it will be a very difficult meeting. And the Chinese are actually very sensitive to the way we talk about them. So I don't think the meeting is going to go quite that way. I think, again, that's more public bluster by the president.
I got to jump in. I wasn't looking at the clock clearly. It's time for news, and then we'll pick up after news. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about a variety of foreign policy issues during this hour. President Donald Trump says the United States will unilaterally solve the nuclear threat from North Korea if China fails to help out. Ahead of this week's visit to Mar-a-Lago by China's president, we are talking with our guest about the dangers posed by North Korea and how the U.S. should proceed. We will also talk about President Trump's meeting with Egypt's leader yesterday, the latest on Russia's involvement with the November election, and some more news about unmasking there. And we are welcoming your input. How big a threat do you think North Korea is, and what do you hope comes out of the meeting with China's president? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We are talking with Jeremy Suri, who is the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs, History, and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. Thomas on Facebook says, I agree China should be pressed, but I completely disagree with a threatening ultimatum. There is a word that Trump needs to learn and understand. It's called diplomacy. Just before news time, Professor Suri, I kind of cut you off. How do you think this meeting is going to go between Trump and China's president?
I think it will be cordial. I think they will be respectful of each other. I don't think anything big will be accomplished, but I don't think it will be a disaster either. I think they'll end up talking about two issues more than anything else. They're going to talk about economic issues. Trump wants to protect American jobs, and the Chinese want the United States to keep our market open to their exports. And so they're going to talk about that. And I think they're also going to talk about stability in East Asia. But I don't think they're going to have any specific progress on North Korea. And I don't think President Trump will bring up issues of human rights in China, as almost every president has before. If his meeting with the Egyptian leader of yesterday is any indication, I don't think he has any interest in talking about those issues.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit more about that. President Trump did welcome in the Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, to the White House. Egypt is one of the Muslim allies that Trump said America should work with to fight ISIS. He is taking a different approach to Egypt than President Barack Obama did, who never invited el-Sisi to the White House and was critical of the country's human rights record. What do you make of Trump's change in attitude here?
I think he sees el-Sisi as a strongman ally who will do our bidding, in particular in taking anti-terrorist measures, as Trump defines them, and in trying to control what Trump sees as threatening regimes in the region, in particular Iran. So he sees al-Sisi as a pro-American dictator, and he's willing to embrace that. And that has not been the policy of the United States, at least for the last decade. But this is a shift in American preferences in the region.
Well, with all this going on with North Korea and China and Egypt, Russia is still a hot topic. Here again is U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley weighing in on whether Russia meddled into the presidential election.
Certainly, I think Russia was involved in the election. There's no question about that. And I think when they finish with all of this process, yes, they need to address Russia, they need to act, and they need to make sure they're loud about it. We don't want any country involved in our elections ever.
So what do you make of that comment?
Well, I don't know who the they is that she's referring to, Ambassador Haley. I think what we're learning more and more every day is that there wasn't just Russian penetration of our election, that there's been a broad effort by the Russian security and intelligence services to undermine our political system. That's really what it is. Vladimir Putin sees democracy and American-style governance as a threat to his authority, not just in Russia, but in what he calls the near abroad, the area around Russia, Central Asia, Eastern Europe. And he's been doing everything he can, in essence, fighting a war against our system. And what is very disheartening is that the governing regime under President Trump and many Republicans, not all Republicans in Congress, seem not to want to talk about this. And one has to wonder why a set of members of Congress in particular who are traditionally hardliners on Russia all of a sudden don't want to talk about these issues and seem to want to cover it up or make up other issues that don't exist and are unrelated to this. This is a major security issue. It's actually larger than the election. It's larger than who's president. It's about the safety, sanctity, and furtherance of our democracy and the effort by another regime to undermine our democracy. We never would have tolerated this from the Soviets. And why Republicans are not speaking out about this now should worry many, many people.
Why aren't Republicans speaking out on it?
I think they see short-term political damage to their party if they do, because there are a number of individuals in their party who have benefited from this. Whether they were directly colluding with Russia or not, we don't know. But if they benefited and didn't do anything to react to it and accepted the benefits, that does not look good for them. And so in the short run, this will not be a good thing for the Republican Party. And they're placing their short-term interests ahead of the long-term interests of the country. And the person who has said that most clearly is a Republican Senator, John McCain, criticizing his own party on this.
Yeah. You know, we've done more than a few shows on this, and I've also heard from listeners who are Trump supporters saying, you know, this is not a big deal. This happens all the time. We have interfered in other countries' elections just because maybe the Soviets or the Russians were able to hack into emails is no big deal, and that's not it's not why President Trump is president. So why are Democrats in particular saying this is such a big deal?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a fair question to ask, and it should be addressed clearly and in an objective way as much as possible. And so I'd say there are three reasons, and these really are not about who's president. And in fact, again, this is larger than the question of who's president. First, we have meddled in other people's elections, and one of the lessons we've learned, I thought we had learned over the last 20 years, certainly one of the things that we as historians have been talking a lot about, is how counterproductive that is. And when we did it in the past, it was not right, and Republican and Democratic presidents have said that. George W. Bush said that as well. So, first of all, we made mistakes in the past. That does not justify our encouraging others to do that today, and we certainly shouldn't. Second, this is not just about hacking emails. This is about a concerted attempt by another regime, and there's extensive evidence of this, to undermine our system. That is the equivalent of a terrorist attack. What did the terrorists try to do on September 11th in New York City and in Washington, D.C.? They tried to undermine our system by attacking institutions of business and government. That's exactly what's going on here. This is cyber terrorism sponsored by a state. If we don't accept terrorism sponsored by a state in the Middle East, why would we accept it sponsored by Russia? And then there's a third reason, perhaps the most important one. Other parts of the world are watching. We have benefited enormously over the last 70 years from countries, from Germany to Japan and many others, choosing systems like our own over others. That's how we won the Cold War. If the system of democracy and capitalism is undermined by someone like Vladimir Putin, it undermines American interests all around the world, and we will pay a huge, huge price for that. So this is real stuff. This is serious stuff. This is not about who's president. This is about our democratic system, and anyone who's patriotic needs to care about this.
Haley did not call for any punishment against Russia for meddling, but said we should wait for the investigation to be complete and to respond accordingly. So, what does the U.S. do if you know, if Russia put out fake news stories and hacked emails and meddled in our election? What does how does the U.S. respond to that?
Well, the first thing we have to do, and it's frustrating that we haven't done this, and this is something that Ambassador Haley could do herself, is we should start revealing the evidence and talking about it and condemning it, so at the very least, other countries can see what's happening. There are major elections occurring in France and Germany in coming months, as well as many other countries, and there's a lot of evidence the Russians are doing the same thing as theirs. So the first thing we can do is talk about it, make it clear. One of the ways we won the Cold War was exposing Soviet misdeeds. We should be exposing what the Russians have done. People should know about it. We should stop denying it and stop making false accusations about other people who have nothing to do with the Russians who didn't do anything. So that's the first thing, and Ambassador Haley could start this. She could start doing that when she speaks. She's been briefed in on a lot of this. Second, we could encourage a true, rigorous investigation. Members of Congress have undertaken serious investigations of all kinds of people, from Richard Nixon to Hillary Clinton. There needs to be a serious investigation here with an independent counsel and a panel, not just of members of the Senate, but of experts who are charged to do this job, as we did at Watergate, as we did in the Benghazi hearings and elsewhere. There needs to be a serious investigation, and Ambassador Haley could call for that. And then the third thing is we do need to make it clear to the Russians that there will be costs. President Obama, before he left office, initiated sanctions, and one of the things that's become clear is that members of the Trump administration immediately said, before they were in office, breaking the law, they said to the Russian leadership that they shouldn't take these sanctions seriously. In essence, you did these bad things, but we're not going to punish you for them. If we're going to talk about punishing the Chinese and the North Koreans, the Russians should be, I think, a little higher on that list.
Yeah. One of the latest developments in this whole saga is that Fox News and some other conservative news media outlets were reporting yesterday that Susan Rice, President Obama's National Security Advisor, was the one who requested the identities of Americans who were cited in intelligence reports about the surveillance of foreign officials and those who were connected with Donald Trump's campaign or the transition, that she was the one who called for the so-called unmasking. Former national security officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity described that this request is normal and legal for the president's top security advisor to understand the context of reports. What light can you shed on this, Professor Suri?
I've tried to read everything I can on this in the last 24 hours, but I don't have any direct inside knowledge. But look, first of all, this is not wiretapping, as President Trump claimed. This is not the President of the United States spying on a candidate. It's nothing like that. It has nothing to do with that. And let's first make sure that that's clear. Everyone with any access to information has made it clear that there was no wiretapping by the President of the United States on any candidate. That was a lie told by President Trump. Second, the National Security Advisor is charged with one job above all else, to protect the national security of the United States from being undermined by foreign actors. And it is normal, I have seen in other cases, not just normal, it is routine, for the National Security Advisor to want to get the names of those agents in the United States who appear to be working for a foreign government around security issues. This happened during both the George H.W. and Bill Clinton administrations, when there was evidence of Chinese spying in the United States. Some might remember the Wen Ho Lee scandal. Chinese-born scientists in the United States who appeared to be sharing scientific secrets with China. The NSC advisor, Sandy Berger, and others requested the names of people the CIA and FBI had information on so they could take appropriate action. That is the job of the top security official of the United States. And there's no evidence that anyone was improperly targeted. What they found was that Michael Flynn, who was Donald Trump's national security advisor in waiting, he was not in government yet, that Flynn was having illegal conversations with the Russians. And that's why Michael Flynn has asked for immunity if he testifies against others. So there's nothing abnormal here. And in fact, it looks like Susan Rice was doing her job no different from what Brent Scowcroft for George H.W. Bush or Condoleezza Rice for George W. Bush would have done in those circumstances. And again, there was no wiretapping of candidate Trump by anyone who in the White House.
How ominous is it for the President Trump specifically that his former national security advisor wants to testify with immunity?
Well, I think it's bad for any leader when one of your very closest advisors, who you've called repeatedly a good person and a key aide to you, is facing imprisonment for breaking the law and sharing secrets and lying. That's just bad news, right? Whether you're a CEO, a university president, or president of the United States. And usually it doesn't stop there. I don't know exactly where it's going to go, but it's quite clear that Michael Flynn was not the only person who was being paid by Russia and lying about it. And that's really what we're talking about, bribery. There was a lot of money on the table. It appears that there were other people close to Trump who were being paid by Russia. And again, they were people being paid by China in the 1980s and 90s. This is a very serious issue, and it's a serious problem for the administration, and it's not going away as an issue. And I think we're going to see more revelations and more imprisonment. I don't know how high it'll go.
Bernie in Elkhorn is with us. Hello, Bernie.
Good morning. I'm no fan of Donald Trump, but these allegations of Russian hacking are completely false. The propaganda against Russia began well before Trump was elected. Glenn Greenwald, impeccable reporter who brought Edward Snowden forward of The Intercept, Bill Binney, former whistleblower, Julian Assange, all these people have said there's absolutely no evidence to back the charge that Putin had anything to do with this. If you want to look at malfeasance in the U.S. elections, look no further than the disenfranchisement of voters that Greg Palast has talked about, or the Bernie Sanders voters being taken off the rolls that Debbie Luzignan, who does a YouTube under Sane Progressive, talks about, or go to Counterpunch.
Yeah, we're kind of getting off on a different tangent here, Bernie, but how about there's no evidence that Putin was involved in this at all, Professor Suri?
First of all, I appreciate Bernie's wanting to understand these issues, and I think we really do need to understand these issues. And I want to make it clear that when I say there's been Russian efforts to undermine American democracy, I don't say that lightly. That's not propaganda on my part. And just so people know, I'm one of a group of many who have been critical of President Obama for being too weak on Russia. So this is not support for President Obama's policies by my saying that either. But the evidence is overwhelming of Russian efforts to undermine American democracy. I encourage anyone who's interested to watch and listen to the hearings where James Comey, the director of the FBI, made this quite clear. I would encourage anyone who's interested to follow the very good reporting that's been done not just by left-leaning publications, but by publications like the Wall Street Journal and Financial Times, in addition to the Washington Post and the New York Times. I would encourage anyone to talk to people who have been in government over the last year, and don't just talk to people in the U.S., talk to people in Germany and in France and elsewhere. It is overwhelming. The consensus is so strong on this. It is similar to the consensus on evidence of Chinese currency manipulation.
Yeah, let me jump in because we do have news next from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and we'll continue talking about the investigation into Russian meddling in the U.S. election and whether there was any collusion with Trump administration campaign or transition officials after we check the latest news. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Jeremy Suri, who is a chair for leadership in global affairs, history, and public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. talking with him about a number of foreign policy issues in the news this week. Talking now about the very latest news when it comes to the Russian meddling in the U.S. presidential election. And we are welcoming your questions and views on this. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Jeremy Suri is also the author of the forthcoming book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, which is due out in September. And we'll have him back to talk about that when it's out, but give us a preview, Professor Suri. What do you mean by the rise and fall of America's highest office?
So this is an effort to really look at the history of the American presidency over the last 220 years or so. It's not just about Donald Trump. It's not really about Donald Trump at all, actually. And the book argues, my research argues, that over time the power and responsibilities of the presidency have grown so great that the office is in some ways destined to fail. Presidents are trying to do too much for too many people too many times. And what happens then is we become very dissatisfied with this powerful office that's underproducing for us as a people and a society, and we start looking for figures who promise to blow it up because we think the problem is the person in office. And my argument is actually the problem is the structure of the office. We need to think about reforming the presidency so it can be more accountable to the people, so it can be more effective in doing its job, and so it can emphasize American priorities rather than the wide, wide range of issues that presidents work on and work on in ways that actually don't serve the national interest. Yeah.
Do you think that President Trump is going to last in office?
Well, all presidents have to leave office at some point. I have trouble considering the pace we're on to see how this lasts 4 years. I don't know exactly. There are all kinds of scenarios one can play out where his presidency ends before 4 years. But just the pace of scandal, the pace of difficulty, the degree to which he seems profoundly upset in office, and the rate at which he's losing advisors, the incompetence that we're seeing day in and day out, it's hard to see it lasting for 4 years, but who knows?
Art in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Art.
Hi. Well, I have two points. I completely agree all the evidence about any Russian interference should be issued. I don't agree that there's a consensus. Well, yeah, there is a consensus, just like we had a consensus around the Iraq War. There was a complete consensus. There just wasn't facts to prove it. So I'd like to see the evidence. I think Glenn Greenwald and Robert Perry are right on as investigative journalists who've exposed this. And my second point is the idea that we won the Cold War because we felt so bad about our occasional meddling is wrong. Major reason we won the Cold War is we meddled so much, and particularly in 1996 when there was a very good chance the communists in Russia were going to win the election. Time magazine cover story in July, you know, Yanks to the rescue about our intervention, convincing Yeltsin's forces to break the rules, ignore the spending limits, etc. All this very low-level scare tactics, telling everybody in the stores that they wouldn't be able to get food again if Yeltsin didn't win. But, you know, when we have not succeeded in intervening in the elections of other countries, like massively in Italy when the communists were so strong, and this is all documented, it's just not publicized, then we would overthrow the governments. So Chile, yeah. Iran, and Guatemala are three examples where our interference was not successful, so we actually overthrew the elected governments.
Yeah, so you're, all right, again, the U.S. meddles all the time, and maybe even more so, and there really isn't evidence. There might be a consensus,
sure,
that could be wrong, that Russia meddled in ours.
So Art raises good questions, and I will address them directly and fairly. They're good questions. The United States did meddle a lot in the Cold War, particularly in many of the places Art mentioned, Guatemala, Iran, elsewhere. And in fact, this has been extensively written about. I'm one of the people who's written about this, but many others have, too. My point was, in fact, the evidence seems to indicate those activities in the end hurt us. We did not win the Cold War because of meddling in Guatemala or Iran. We won the Cold War because citizens in East Germany, Hungary, Poland, and elsewhere, including in Russia, and including a man named Mikhail Gorbachev, the leader of the Soviet Union, decided that elements of our system were preferable to the kind of system they were living under. Gorbachev was trying to reform communism to bring in what he thought saw as a third way, and many East Germans, Poles, Czechs, many whom I know, were fed up with communism and saw the American-style system not as nirvana, but as a better alternative. We didn't win because we meddled. I was in Russia in 1996 during the Yeltsin election that Art referred to. There were a lot of Americans over there, but the vote for Yeltsin was not controlled by the United States. We certainly had a preference, but we were not sending false news. We were not controlling their media. In fact, Russia had a vibrant media in 1996. What's the evidence today? Art asks whether this is another false consensus. It's very different from Iraq. I'll remind Art, he knows this. He lived through this. During the Iraq War, there were a lot of people arguing for us to go to war in Iraq, but there was no consensus among the intelligence agencies that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. In fact, the consensus among the intelligence agencies was that he did not. It was the Bush administration that was pushing false news about that. The consensus then was pretty clearly that Hussein probably didn't, or they weren't sure that he had the weapons that they claimed he had. So it's very different from this moment now. And if you just want a piece of evidence of Russian meddling, just go online and put up a message of your own criticizing something Putin has done, maybe the treatment of human rights at home or the way he's cut off the media, and find, as I do anytime I write something, the overwhelming number of trolls with names that you don't recognize who can easily, by any IT security person, be traced back to Russia, be traced back to the Russian government. Last I checked, the U.S. government does not employ trolls to go attack people online. The Russian government has an army of people doing that. That's just one piece of evidence that I have felt and seen myself. This is a concerted effort by the Russian government to cut off people in foreign countries saying things they don't want said.
There was a report recently, too, that Russia is getting involved, meddling in elections in Europe as well, in France and Germany, among others. And in fact, wanting one candidate to win over the other. Can you talk about that? About how Russia is also trying to get their candidate to win in France and Germany?
Sure. So. Well, Marine Le Pen, the right-wing candidate in France, has visited with Putin and praised him, and he has praised her, and there's a lot of evidence of money being transferred from Russia as loans to her party and to her supporters. And the Russian government sponsors all kinds of news sites, false news sites, spreading false rumors, spreading lies in France and in Germany. And this is a real serious issue in these countries. One of the main things that Russia has done is it's created these sites like RTV and Sputnik that look like they're real news sites, but they're not. Last I checked, the U.S. government does not run a news site. We do not send out news propaganda around the world. Even when we use Voice of America and things like that, they're set up as independent chartered organizations. These are what the Russians are doing, are setting up government-sponsored propaganda machines and trying to make them look like real news sites, and that's intentionally confusing people in these societies.
Saeed in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. The transition of power from the Obama administration to Trump is likely the worst transition of power that I am aware of in American history. And vis-a-vis Russia, when an exiting administration in the last week of their reign expels 40 Russian diplomats, they are cornering the incoming administration into a very bad position. Russia is a significant geopolitical player. American interest is very much tied in our ability to coexist and to collaborate potentially in certain areas with the Russians. The outgoing administration has essentially tied the hands of the incoming administration in dealing with the situation. Any gesture that Trump makes to try to achieve some level of collaboration or cooperation, particularly we need the Russians in dealing with Iran. We need the Russians in dealing in Syria. And the current president has his hands completely tied.
Do you agree, Professor Suri?
No. I see where Saeed is coming from, and I appreciate his point that this has been one of the worst and roughest transitions. That said, I think actually the outgoing administration did all it could to try to make this as smooth as possible. The outgoing president contacted the incoming president numerous times, attempted to prepare him for office. They were prepared, I know, many offices in Washington with all kinds of transition materials, and there was no one on the incoming administration side to receive them. The 40 diplomats who were expelled by President Obama, that was a very light response. He was trying not to tie the hands. He had direct evidence that we've now seen of Russian efforts to meddle in the election, direct evidence that the Russians hacked Democratic emails, that they were taking voter lists from sites all around the country, that they were doing all sorts of stuff. And this was actually a very light response, not a very hard response. And many Republicans said that. And if Hillary Clinton had been coming into power, they certainly would have said, there's another example of Democratic weakness, not doing anything. He did not tie President Trump's hands at all on Russia. What has tied President Trump's hands on Russia is the evidence of people around Trump being excessively positive, having almost bromance relationships with Vladimir Putin, and that discredits that administration now when they do pursue positive diplomatic moves towards Putin, because now you wonder why. There's also the question of economic interests. If they've profited and collected loans and been paid thousands of dollars by the Russian government, as Michael Flynn was illegally, that makes you wonder why they're pursuing diplomatic overtures. So what has tied their hands, the Trump administration, is their own behavior on these issues. You reap what you sow.
And we will have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us. Jeremy Suri, Mack Brown, Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs, History, and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Brianne Chasso for producing this program. Thank you for listening. Hope you stay tuned. Much more to come. It's On Your Money with financial planner Kevin McKinley coming up next. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.